Okay. We're continuing with the various of the Arba Nizikim, the four classic types of damages that appear in Sefer Mishpatim, in Parshat Mishpatim, and mostly appears in the Gemara and Bava Kamma. And we're following through the Sefer Chinuch's understanding. And we have a slight problem with the Sefer Chinuch on all these issues, because what we usually spend a good portion of our class dealing with is how the Sefer Chinuch understands the meaning of these particular mitzvot. And as he's done for the last few mitzvot, he continues here as well by saying, I don't have to give you an explanation because it's pretty obvious. It's just a natural way of organizing a society that you have to take care of your property so it doesn't cause damages to others. So we'll be a little bit creative in trying to understand what the essence of this particular mitzvah is. So if you want to follow along with me, in the source sheet, you see the title is fire, because that is one of the four Av Nizikim, the paradigmatic forms of damages. If you look at the Sefer Chinuch itself, we'll go to the third source. Mitzvot Beit Din, these are all a mitzvah on the Beit Din to adjudicate a certain way. It is a mitzvah of the Beit Din, Ladun Beniske Ha'esh, to adjudicate damages that are caused by fire. What does that mean? I'm now switching to the English. To judge and obligate one, make someone obligated to pay. One who has damaged his fellow with fire, to pay, for example, if he lit his stockpile or burned anything of his on your property. As it is stated, if a fire goes out, there's two possible meanings if a fire goes out in English. If a fire is extinguished, but in Hebrew it's clear what's meant is if a fire goes out, it leaves where it starts, and it goes beyond your property line. It implies even if it goes on its own, you've lit a fire, you create little campfire, and the fire jumps, and it goes out all by itself. Nothing that you did to actually encourage it to go out. You didn't fan it, but it goes out on its own. If it goes to your neighbor's property, you now are liable for the damage that it actually does. What? It can happen with Shabbos candles. It's an interesting thing. In fact, unfortunately, it sometimes does happen. A fire, Shabbos candles, they hit curtains, they burn a person's house, and then that house burns the next house. Now, there's mitigating factors, which we're going to get to, of whether or not you're actually liable in these instances. But the general principle is that you're going to be liable if it's your fire, and it goes out of your house or out of your property. It comes to warn even if one lit on his own property and it went out on its own and damaged, he is liable since he did not watch his coals. This is an important phrase that the Sefer Chinuch uses, because he did not watch his coals. So there's an element of potential negligence here. Okay? Yes. What do you mean by that? Oh, so the second house is not responsible for the third house. It all emanates from the first house. It's the same fire, so to speak, right? It's all emanating from his particular house. Okay, the source of this, I brought the Torah source above. It's the first source from Shemot, right? Ki teitzei esh, when the fire goes out and it spreads to thorns, and so that stack standing or growing grain is consumed. Okay, there's two things therefore consumed. There's thorns and thistles, and then also someone's field, actual growing items. When we get to sort of the symbolism of fire, those two things will be of some relevance. He who started the fire must make restitution. Okay, so that's the general principle. You light a fire, it starts on your property, it goes out, you are ultimately responsible for that. We'll see a sense of the responsibility by going to the next couple of sources. If you look at the Rambam down below, so from Hilchot Niske Mamon, that this entire chapter 14 is all about this. I just brought two of the examples that sort of limit, create some of the cases that we're talking about. When a person kindles a fire on his own property, he must retreat it a sufficient distance from the boundary to ensure that the fire will not spread to a field belonging to a colleague. Okay? So you shouldn't light a fire right next to your on your property line, because there's a good chance it's going to jump over. But if you light it in the middle of your property, and then there's an argument in the Gemara, what does it mean? How far away from the neighbor's property? There's different opinions, but there is a standard by which if you're, you know, on a big big farm and you're, you know, a few hundred meters away from your neighbors and you just have a small little fire, usually you're not going to be responsible, says the Rambam. If you do it so to ensure that the fire does not spread to a field belonging to a colleague, meaning you put rocks around or wood, meaning not the thorns, not the thistles, you've cleared out the path. You know, in San Diego, we were there this summer, there's a whole series of laws that people are obligated in to make sure that wildfires can't go beyond their property. And it's a law. You have to clear out the thistles. You have to clear out those things that are flammable from the edges of your property so that fire can't jump from one place to the next. And if you don't do that, you would actually be liable. If, however, you do that and the fire nevertheless comes and it still spreads, then it's called an act of God. But it's only an act of God if human beings did not do their part. And we're going to come back to that theme a little bit. How far must one move? The Rambam is quoting the Gemara. Everything, the conclusion of the Gemara, it gives different possibilities, depends on the height of the fire. Meaning if it's a small little fire, so it doesn't have to be, you know, miles and miles away. But if you were creating a large fire, for whatever purpose you're doing it, let's say very often it was used for business purposes, for tanning or other... Well, Lag Bomer is an interesting question because it's not really for business purposes, but yeah, Lag Bomer is a good example. Basically, if it's a medium-sized fire, you have a certain... If it's a high fire, you have a greater responsibility. The Rambam does, however, point out... I think this is at the end. The second paragraph. I should just continue the end. Everything depends on the height of the fire. If he did not retreat at an adequate distance and the fire spread, caused damage, he's liable. If he did do the appropriate distance and the fire nevertheless spread and caused damage, he is not liable. It's considered an act of heaven. Similarly, if there's a stream and the fire jumps the stream, we usually don't assume that you're liable for that. If there's a pond of rainwater, similarly. If you created a wall, let's say out of stone, and the height is such that it should stop the fire, you're also not going to be responsible. But then the question is, if the wall falls, if you didn't repair it in time, you would be responsible. If you did repair it on time, all these different things. But all these standards apply when it's called a piercing fire. In the Hebrew, it means a very hot fire, but not necessarily a very big fire. But if you have a very high fire, this connects to Lag Bomer. If you have one of these very large high fires, so much so that the fire is actually falling down on itself, right? So then there's something called strict liability. It's such a big fire, it's going to catch on something, and you're responsible for it, nevertheless, whatever the case may be. Okay. You see here that the nature of fire is different than some of our other damages. The nature of fire is that it's so dangerous, it's unpredictable. You can't tell which way it's going to go. You can't control it. You can't create necessarily a barrier for like we had with Pit or chain it up like you do with your animals. It's not controllable. So the rabbis have a great deal, place a great deal of responsibility on a person in this regard. You can get a sense of just how dangerous fire can be by looking at another halacha to see how the rabbis actually changed the halacha because of the nature of fire. And this actually comes to Shabbat. What's the halacha if there's a fire in your house on Shabbat and it happens? You have a Shabbat candle and it falls. And now it catches on a thing. Now, the Gemara is actually very interesting about this. You're not allowed to put it out. It's one of the 39 malachot. And you actually have to be prepared. If you look at the Gemara on the back of the first page, Shabbat 117, the rabbis say the halacha is clear. You're not allowed to put out the fire. And because they were afraid that you'd be tempted to put out the fire because you want to save your property, the rabbis made it even strict of how much property you could save. You're not allowed to save actually that much property. If you look at the Mishnah, right? The Mishnah says, Matzilin mazon shalosh sudot haru'i. If it's Shabbat, if it's Friday night, you're allowed to run out of the house, but only with the clothes on your back. It says a few books of your, you know, holy books. and enough food for Shabbos. You can't save more than that. What? No pictures. No, you can't take other things. Because what the reasoning of the rabbis is as follows. It's a deraita law that you're not allowed to put out the fire. You're going to be tempted to put out the fire to save all your property. So to make sure that you don't actually care about your property, they force you to run outside without it. Just enough food that you have. And by the way, there's different opinions, but the Gemara goes on. It says, you take if the fire happens Shabbat morning, you can only take food for two meals. You've lost Friday night already. You've eaten. And if it's, you know, right before Suda Shlishit, you can only take food for one meal. Ultimately, that's rejected, and you could take enough food for all of Shabbos regardless. They weren't going to get involved when you have Shabbos lunch and when you have Suda Shlishit and everything like that. But it's clear that you're not allowed to, not only can you not save the house, you're not allowed to really save your property. And the underlying principle here, it's a very powerful principle if you think about it, is that there has to be certain values that are more important than our property. And Shabbos is one of them. I read this story by this scholar in America by the name of Gil Student. He tells the story when he was a teenager. He was like on a Shabbaton, and he was walking home from the shul with a bunch of his friends, and it's Friday night, and they met up with a group of non-Jewish teenagers who were also walking in the same direction. They started talking and schmoozing, and they're talking about Shabbos. What are you doing? Why are you walking? You know, we're walking because we live here. You're walking because you can't drive. Anyway, they start talking and asking different questions. And one of the questions the kids ask, they say, wait a second. They're explaining the things they can't do on Shabbat. You mean to tell me if there's a $20 bill on the street, it's lost. You're not taking from anyone. You can't pick it up and just put it in your pocket and walk away? It's Shabbat. And just because it's Shabbat? And he said, no, can't. And by the way, I'm sure many of you can sort of picture both the simplicity and the ridiculousness of that. On one hand, if you can look from the outside, that's crazy. I can't pick up this $20 bill, but the simplicity of it is, it's almost like it's not money, right? When you're inside the world of Shabbos, it's of course you don't do it. There's not even almost a temptation because it's as if it's something otherworldly. And he says it really kind of impressed these young non-Jews. It also, they surprised them. They said, isn't that crazy? But they were also impressed because they saw that there are certain values that people hold that are more than money. And if you think about America today and Western society in general, there seems to be no greater value than the pursuit of the holy dollar. So here you have this idea, and that's what the rabbis are saying. There's certain things that are more important than value. And that's the halakha, or at least that was the halakha. Mm. He's actually attacked for that by some, yes.
Yeah, but there are others that say the importance of one's
pride. Right, right.
They use just the opposite.
Correct, correct.
And the fact that they're reading that, that the value, you know, like, don't think that your property is not worth something.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. So there's a machloket almost about that. And by the way, history sometimes plays a role in these things. For example, the Clear Car lived in a very wealthy time. And he saw in his generation that people were taking advantage and the wealth was, in a sense, distorting the halacha. And if you read his commentaries, he's always picking on the problems of wealth and emphasis on property. And I think his commentary with regards to that attacks Yaakov for going back. And then there are other times which absolutely doesn't have a problem at all. And if you look at the Torah, the pshat in the Torah itself, right? The fact that Avraham has lots of sheep and is viewed as a positive, not a negative. So you're sometimes they're influenced by you know your own experiences. But what's interesting is we're going to see the halacha change more in your direction. Okay, at this point in time, the Talmud makes a very radical statement because it's trying to make a point. However, over time, it does change. So possibly we're going to, the Talmud doesn't speak about this, but subsequent sources do move more in that direction. So, let me explain how the halacha develops a little bit. The Rabbeinu Tam introduces the first major leniency. Now it's the 12th century. And he basically says, the restriction only applies on the person whose house the fire breaks out in. He's not allowed to save his property, but the next door neighbor, he could take as much time as he wants, and because the fire hasn't come there yet, so he doesn't have the temptation to put out the fire yet, so he could save all of his property. So the property does have value at this point in time.
Second guy's, not the first guy's.
The first guy is really in a real dilemma. Not only can he save his property, he can't put out the fire. I mean, there's a real whole series of things that the Gemara is very strict in that regard. As I said, if you want to read through, you can see the Gemara that I brought for you, Mishnah, and then the on Shabbat 117b. You'll notice, by the way, there are some, you know, kvetches of how you can sort of help save your property. For example, you can't actively put out the fire, but you are allowed, for example, to have a glass of water, and you're allowed to spill the water on, you know, the tablecloth, not where the fire is, but where in front of you. And then when the fire gets to it, it goes out. But you didn't put out the fire. You simply... non-Jew. Loss. Implying... right. There might be a reward, but I can't offer it to you right now for halakhic reasons, you know? So you hope that the non-Jews who come and save you, you know, really have learned the Gemara enough to know what that means.
But if the second house already catches fire, then the person in that house can't.
Yeah, he's in the same category then, exactly.
Can the person from the second house,
or does
the favor go to the first house?
Not, well, if he's Jewish... he can't put out the fire because it's...
It'd
be an interesting idea because it's not of value to him. Actually, the sources don't usually speak about that because the halacha changes, okay? For example, after Rabbeinu Tam gives that, there's subsequent sources. The Isser Vehetta, for example, says that the exact opposite of what the Talmud says. The Talmud says, because you're going to be tempted because of your property, you're going to be tempted to put out the fire. He says the exact opposite. It says, if you don't save your property, you'd be tempted to put out the fire. So we encourage people to save their property so they don't have the temptation, because otherwise the temptation is too great. And so he says, save all your property. In fact, you could save also things that are muksa. Just make sure every time you run in and out of the house, you take something that's not muksa, and you put something muksa on top of it, and you run out with that. So there's a whole... dynamic. Now, what's really interesting is in the 1500s and 1600s, there's even a further development. And the further development is in about the 1600s, you have people, I would say around 1640, 1650, 1660, start saying about there's another concern here altogether. In fact, a little bit before that, even in the 1500s, if you lived amongst non-Jews, if a house broke out, if a fire broke out in your house amongst the Jews, very often there were riots whenever fires broke out. And more than that, if they ever found out whose house the fire started in, very often they would go and kill that person. So as a matter of pikuach nefesh, you were allowed to put out the fire. And then that was expanded, as I said, in the mid-1600s, where it said that you have another problem. If you let the fire burn your house and it catches someone else's house, so most people will escape. But you know what? There's always going to be sick people. There's always going to be young children who won't get out of the house in time, and therefore it now no longer is permitted. It's a mitzvah. You must, if fire breaks out in your house, you absolutely are commanded to put it out, meaning it changes the Torah law. Not only the rabbinic law of not taking your property, changes the Torah law, and it applies, by the way, even today. Rav Asher Weiss was asked this question. He says, well, maybe now we live amongst all Jews, and you have stone houses, fires don't jump so quickly. Maybe we don't have the fear of a non-Jew killing the person who's... maybe we're not allowed to put out a fire on Shabbat if it happens in our house. He says it's not true. First of all, fire can jump to houses even if there's a lot of stone. More than that, there's a lot of electrical wires. There's a lot of gas leaks, things like that. And if you let a fire burn in a house, it could explode these gas things. The explosion could expand. It's bikuach nefesh, all these other things. And again, you have a mitzvah to put out a fire in your house. So there's two things that are interesting here. One is you see how the halakha absolutely changes. The Gemara starts with an important value about valuing property and valuing Shabbat, but the actual practical halakha changes dramatically because of the fear of fire being uncontrolled can just wreak havoc and can destroy so much and can kill people. And so therefore you see the rabbis are very concerned about that over generations. Make sure we take the proper precautions in that regard. So you have this great sense of responsibility. But I want to return to the Rambam for just a moment. Because when you return to the Rambam, you see that while the rabbis place a great deal of responsibility on us to be careful with our fires, they don't place absolute responsibility. Right? The Rambam says, if you put it far enough away, if you build a fence that's high enough, and if it just happens to jump over, okay, so you're not going to be held responsible. That, by the way, is the development of secular law as well. Secular law starts off by saying, already in the common law in England, starts off by saying, you know what, if you don't do something affirmatively to damage someone else's property, you're not responsible at all. You know, you have a fire on your property and it goes into someone else's property, that's what insurance is for. You know, that's not your fault. The case was decided. The first time someone was held responsible in British law, someone was apparently hunting, and he hunted and he was shooting at a fowl of some sort on someone else's property. And when he missed the fowl, but he apparently combusted in a shed or something like that, there was some flammable material, and that went on fire. And he says, for that, the court judge says, for that you're liable, because you shot into someone else's property, so that you're liable. But if you just are doing something on your property and the fire spreads, you're not responsible at all. That's the common law in the 1600s, 1700s, 1800s. By the way, just going back to what we said before, anyone know what happened in 1606 that might have influenced some of these rabbis? Well, there's a London fire, and there is also a fire in Prague that really devastated these cities. I'm sorry? Oh, so anyway, this is a time of fires where cities were really destroyed. The London fire certainly is one of the bigger one as well. So I 1666? Okay. So, I think earlier. Yeah. She said 1666. I actually, believe it or not, wrote it down. Okay, yes, I don't know. Anyway, the London fire was 1666. So the rabbis, the Rambam, he's quoting the Mishnah, does not put absolute responsibility. Right? It says you could take certain precautions, and if it goes beyond, we're going to say that's okay. And as I said, secular law basically did not hold people responsible. That was the original law. Then there was a new case called the Reynolds versus Fletcher or something to that effect, which basically created a new law in England that a person bought a property and he decided to dam it up, to create a dam. And he built the dam and the dam exploded. And the water went into the next person's property, and he had mines in that other, and it flooded the mines. And the principal law until that point in time said, tough. He didn't actually shoot into your thing. It left his property, but he didn't purposely do it. He created it, and that's what they made the change. They said, if you have a dangerous item, and a dam was considered a dangerous item, we're going to hold you fully responsible for whatever damage it ends up doing to the other thing. By the way, Jewish law would make another slight distinction. Jewish law would make another slight distinction, by the way, here, which is you're going to be liable for what happens on the other person's property, but not if their property was used for other reasons. What do I mean by that? If you have a fire that goes to your neighbor's property and he was burying a treasure underneath the field. Since most fields don't have treasures, you're not liable to pay for the treasure. You're only liable to pay for the damage of the normal damage. Whereas in the British law at this point in time, in this new law, Fletcher law, he became responsible for whatever damage he was done. It was called strict liability. You have something dangerous in your fields, in your property, you're going to be held 100% responsible no matter what happens to it. Don't build a dam in your property. It's too dangerous. So this law was then tested many, many years later, in the 19th century, then the 20th century. There's a famous case called Western Tire versus Gore. And in this case, this guy had fields and fields of tires in his property, not kept very organized. And there was an electrical fire. And the electrical fire then caught the tires on fire. And tires are very difficult to put out. In fact, there have been cases where tire fires have lasted for months and months because they're very difficult to put out. And so Gore, the neighbor, says, wait a second. He had on his property something dangerous, these tires that can't be put out. And since he has these tires on his property that can't be put out, he is therefore liable based upon the Fletcher principle that you shouldn't have dangerous things on your property or else you're going to be held 100% liable. You're disagreeing. Why? Ah, there you go. So the Gore wins. What? So the district court agreed with you and you. You disagreed with her. So the district court agreed with you and said, these tires are dangerous. You can't control if they get caught on fire. It's just like the Fletcher case. It's like a dam. It's dangerous. When it goes up to the higher court, however, the higher court says, wait a second. Tires by themselves are not dangerous. Tires only become dangerous when someone sets them on fire. So you can have tires. We're not going to hold you strict liability. We're only going to hold you the person who starts the fire. And it happened to be there was an accident, electrical. So you could turn to the electrician, but you can't hold this guy responsible because the tires themselves are not in and of itself. That, by the way, and that's the state of the law today. You can, if you have something that's dangerous, but not dangerous by in and of itself, you're not held by strict liability. If it's absolutely dangerous, like the high Lag BaOmer fire, then you're going to be held responsible no matter what. But if you take general precautions, or if you don't have a fire otherwise, you're not. And by the way, that's interesting. Is the halacha precedes this conclusion from the 1900s by a few thousand, whatever, 1800 years, a little bit more than that. If you look at the Mishnah Bava Kamma at the bottom of the second page, or meaning the bottom of the second side. And if you want to read the English, we can go up on the top of the third. One who sends a fire in the hands of a deaf mute, a shote, or a minor. Okay, these are people who don't have responsibility. They are exempt by the laws of man, but they're liable by the laws of heaven. Meaning, you let, by the way, the Mishnah, the Gemara goes on and clarifies this. If you give like some coals to a shote or a miner, and they cause a fire. The coals themselves are not fire. You're not going to be held liable because they're the ones who did it and they don't really have total control. However, you're still liable because obviously that was careless on some level. You didn't realize that they would perhaps create a fire. So you're morally responsible, just not legally. However, the Gemara goes on and says, if you actually give them the means to create a whole fire, you're going to be liable for that as well. If he sent to the hands of a person of sound senses, the one who sound senses is liable. If one brought the fire and another brought the wood, this is the line that I wanted to show you how it parallels the case of Western Tire versus Gore. If one brought the fire and another brought the wood, he that brought the wood is liable. Interestingly, you have a fire in and of itself. That's not a danger. It's only when fire needs participation. Fire needs oxygen. If you, the one who brings the oxygen is the one responsible. Yeah. The fire, yeah, for sure. Meaning, she, correct. Unless the one who lent it to a person who she knows not to be responsible. Okay. The Mishnah goes on. If one brought the wood and another brought the fire, it's he who brought the fire that is liable. Meaning, fire by itself is not dangerous. Wood by itself is dangerous. It's only when you bring the addition, and that's what the court held. The court held tires are not dangerous. It's only when there's some additional outside, which is the fire. And then you hold the person for the fire, but not for having just the tires themselves. So you see, the Mishnah actually, in a sense, saw the development of law in this regard. Now, what I see here, yeah.
But,
Well, it has to. You have to think about what it might have been in those days. Yeah. So fire is, you know, fire sometimes is coals that are still burning, or some the, you know, the main principle is not so much the fire or the wood. The main principle is fire needs participation. Fire needs a few things, right? Fire needs oxygen to keep it going. Fire needs something flammable, right? You know, so we call the wood the fuel. So I guess the initial ignition is the fire itself, which could be fires were kept, right? Fires were always kept going, and it was important to keep them going. And you know when you're out at a campsite, someone protects the fire to keep that actual flame going. Right. Okay, so now I want to sort of switch gears a little bit and talk about fire more generically. And the reason why is we just made this point about how fire requires sort of participation. It requires a merging of a few different items. And I'd like to suggest that this merging of different items has actually deep symbolism aside from just practical elements. And you could see it through a question that we can ask or we should ask on the rabbis. The rabbis could have said that fire is so dangerous, right? Fire is like explosives. Fire, which is the law, by the way, if you have explosives, you know, those are things, or Union Carbide. You remember the Union Carbide chemical spill? If you have something that's so dangerous, you're going to be held strict liable no matter what happens. You know, it's just too dangerous, this case of the dam, right? It's an accident waiting to happen, or it's just so big and so problematic that we're going to hold all the expense should be placed upon you because you're introducing this danger to the world. The rabbis don't say that about fire. They actually say fire in itself is fine, and they assume that it's going to be used on a fairly regular basis. So the rabbis chose not to call fire. They call it a damage. What? But they don't call it, they call it as damage, but it's not an absolute hazard. And the question is why? Why did they choose not to simply say, we have the expression, if you play with fire, you're going to get burned, right? Why didn't they just say, that's it, don't play with fire. Leave it to the professionals. There could be at the center of town, you know, where you can have the fire. If you need to do any of your work, you come there. But don't have fire in your own properties. Why did they choose not to do so? So you could give just a practical answer. Fire is necessary for you know, business or for a whole series of elements in one's life. But that practical answer is also a spiritual answer, meaning the rabbis want people to be productive and to be creative. And I think you can get a sense that fire is more than just a means to destroy, but it's also a means to create. It's a tool, and the fact that it destroys is what actually allows it to create. So I want to expand our understanding of fire a little bit in that regard. So let's look at some symbolic understandings of fire. So the first one, I brought a few different Hebrew sources now. We finished the Mishnah. So if you're on the third page, you'll see the Ein Yaakov, right? The Ein Yaakov is... By the way, the Ein Yaakov has a beautiful introduction on fire that you should know, that the Eitz Yosef explains. Actually, I take it back. I'll come back to this in a little bit. It does have a beautiful introduction, but it's not what I originally thought it was. The Ein Yaakov's introduction is about what is the most important mitzvah in the Torah, most important verse in the Torah. One opinion is, V'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. Another... This, by the way, is not connected to the fire at all. I just thought I was saying something, and then I realized it's not. The other is love the Lord your God with all your might, and then love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your might. You know, right? These are two things from Shema, right? Love God, and then v'ahavta l'reicha kamocha. And the third, Ben Pazi says the most important verse in the Torah. Does anyone know Ben Pazi's suggestion? Ben Pazi suggests the most important verse in the entire Torah is the Tamid. Karban, where it talks about you should always bring every day a sacrifice. And the halacha is like Ben Pazzi. The idea of consistency, of continuity, that's the most important thing. So that's the introduction of the Ein Yaakov. I thought there was another thing connected to fire, but it actually appears somewhere else. We'll get to that. Anyway, the Ein Yaakov. So let me just see. So he tells the following. Amar Rabbi Shmuel bar Nachmani, Amar Rabbi Yonatan, Ein poroniyut, there is no punishment ba'al le'olam that comes into the world, ela bizman sheharasha'im ba'olam, except when there are wicked people in the world. The einu mitchilat ela min hatzadikim. But the punishment doesn't begin with the wicked people. It begins with the righteous people. Meaning righteous people will always suffer when there's punishment of the world coming into the world as a result of the wicked. Okay? Where do we know this from? He learns it from our verse. Ki teitze esh, when fire goes out, remember what the fire does first? The fire burns the bristles, the thorns, and then it gets to the standing stalks, and they're consumed. And the way he interprets the way the Torah is written, it says the stalks are consumed first, even though we know that it goes to the thorns, but the way the Hebrew is written, it's ne'achal, they were already consumed. So he says the stalks represent the tzaddikim, the righteous, the thorns and the thistles represent resha'im. By the way, there are many midrashim that talk about the Romans, for example, that are these thorns, you know, they hurt you and you get cut, but they can be destroyed in a minute, you know, with fire. So anyway, he says that righteous people are always going to suffer if there's punishment that's brought into the world on behalf of the wicked. If you look at the bold lines, Rav Yosef, Mai dechtiv, v'atem lo tetzu ish mi petach beito ad bakar, kevan sheniten reshut lemashchit eino mavchin ben tzadikim l'rasha'im, when a destruction comes, the destruction doesn't make a distinction between righteous people and wicked people. And it usually hits the righteous people first. There's a deeper point, I think. The deeper point is that the righteous people are responsible for the behaviors of the wicked people, if for no other reason to protect themselves. That we're all in sort of the same lifeboat. And if someone starts drilling in the lifeboat, you can't say, well, they're doing it wrong, I'm okay. At the end of the day, everyone is going to suffer as a result, and we therefore are responsible for our surroundings. That's the huge difference between Avram Avinu and the yeshiva Shem Ve'ever. Yeshiva Shem Ve'ever is this wonderful, spectacular yeshiva, but only if you enter into the yeshiva. Avram took all of the learning, and he went out to the rest of the world. So that's one of the points. The other specific point, of course, is that fire needs a certain environment in which to survive. It needs the wicked people, but it needs any type of, there has to be the right conditions. And the tzaddikim are the ones who have an influence on those conditions. I was actually just speaking to a friend today at Morning Minyan. Rav Shimshon Jacob told me he's talking today about chassidut and how it spread like fire. I thought it was an interesting analogy. He said it spread like fire. And he started to give me the reasons why it spread like this. And he said it had the right environment, and he talks about how environments help things to spread. He gave the example of Pablo Escobar's hippopotami. Pablo Escobar is a famous drug kingpin from Colombia, and apparently he brought in exotic animals from all around the world to Colombia, and he put them in his farm, and he had, I think, two or three or four hippopotami. And when he was captured and then eventually killed, they took all the animals and they sent them to local zoos. But the hippopotami, they were like too big. They didn't want to deal with it. They said they're going to die. It's Colombia. It's not Africa. They're going to die anyway in a short little while. But the exact opposite happened. Because of there's always water in Colombia. You don't have droughts like you have in Africa. And you have these waterways that they were able to go through. And they have no predators. Right, they didn't have any lions or anything to attack them. So now there's something like 50 or 60 hippopotami, and apparently the villagers like them. There's never been a violent action, and so now the police don't know what to do because they don't think they can capture all these hippopotami. And anyway, so Rav Shimshon's point about this was to say that when you have the proper environment, that's what enables things to grow. So it's not just lighting the fire, but it's also whether or not you allow a certain environment to exist in order for it to spread. You didn't clear your thorns and thistles. That's the responsibility of the tzaddikim. So you see, there's beginning to be a hint that fire, human beings are responsible even when you're not actually responsible for the fire. You're responsible for some of the other elements. And we could see this even more explicitly in the next few sources. Shnei Luchot Abrit. Okay, this is the Shla Kodesh. He, by the way, was born, I believe, in Prague. And I mentioned that because the next source, the Netzach Yisrael, the Maharal, also was in Prague. And so perhaps something was in the water in those days, because they have similar ideas. Ki teitze ish, the fire goes out. Right, umatzah kotzim, and it sets on the thorns on fire. Tam mitzvah zo, the reason for this mitzvah, silko datcha amina, you might have thought, im yata esh me'atzmo, if the fire goes all out by itself, meaning it leaves your property by itself, lo yehe chayav, you wouldn't be obligated. I didn't do it, the fire did it. K'mash malan de tzirich lishmor yisho. No, this is why it teaches us you have to watch over your fire. Shalo teitze, so it won't go out by itself. Afilu me'atzmo, even if you had nothing to do with it, it shouldn't go out. Shetzarich leharchiko, you have to, you know, keep it away from dangerous areas. He then quotes the Gemara, and he says, the Gemara says in Bava Kama, Amru shebala sot onis keretzon. The Gemara came along and made a person that is onus. What's an onus? You have no choice, right? An onus, the way it was always explained to me, is you're standing by doing nothing. Someone comes along and lifts you up and starts using you to beat another person, to kill another person. You, who got picked up by this other person, are onus. You didn't mean to do anything. It was against your will, in fact. But the Gemara changes that, and it takes an onus and makes him like a ritzon, a will. You didn't do anything, but the Gemara says, you know what? We're going to hold you responsible nevertheless. V'she'enu mitkaven k'mitkaven. And someone who didn't have an intention, as if you had an intention. Mikol makom im ne'achal gadish shalem yishalem. It doesn't matter. If someone's crops are burned, you're going to have to pay for that. Yesh b'kan remez le'esh ha'machloket. He now takes that idea of the Gemara, that we hold you responsible even if you yourself didn't do anything, just passively allowed it to happen, so to speak. And he connects it to another idea. He connects it to the Eish of anger, right? It's similarly, if there's the fire of Machloket and the Eish of anger, Eish HaKa'as. Shatzarich lishmor shmira yitira. You have to give yourself an additional guarding. Shelo teitzei memenu. This fire should not leave you. Machloket and anger. Afilu shelo yibim kaven be'onis. Even if you didn't do it intentionally, even if you're not trying to be angry, you have to have an additional be extra careful. Rabbi Yisrael Salant has a beautiful teaching about the Reshut HaRabim. If you remember, we said you can't put things in the Reshut HaRabim, in the public domain, like a skateboard. Someone could fall on it and could be dangerous. He says, our feelings are Reshut HaYachid. How we feel about another person, no one knows. But our face is Reshut HaRabim. People can see our face. So even if you're angry at someone, you can't reveal that you're angry with a person because you've now created a damage in the Reshut HaRabim. This happens all the time. You're not even angry at a person. You're feeling maybe a little bit depressed for one reason or the other, and you meet someone, and they think the reason why you're upset is because of them. It has nothing to do with them. And they then go and have a bad day because they think you're upset with them. And Rabbi Israel Salanter therefore says, you know what, you have to wear a smile, even if you don't feel that way, because your face is in the Reshut HaRabim. And if you smile, people will think, even if you hate them, you like them, and they'll have a better day as a result. So you have to be careful of what you put out there, even if you don't intend to actually do it. What?
But if I looked at you with a dirty face,
yeah,
and you had a bad day, then you had a bad face on you, and you affected these others.
Yes, absolutely. It's true.
So now you're guilty also.
Listen, the fact that there are other people who are guilty doesn't relieve me, or are you, from also being guilty, right? That's the beauty of Judaism. Judaism assumes we're all wrong. We're all guilty. We all have to improve somehow. Okay. We can go another step in the Netzach Yisrael. Okay, the Netzach Yisrael is going to show that humans are responsible even further. Darash Zeh Mina Katuv, the same verse, Ki Teitzei Eish, when the fire goes out, you have to pay nevertheless. And let's be careful, exact in the what the it says. She'amar Tchilat Ki Teitzei Eish. It says, first of all, the Eish goes out. It's assuming that it goes out by itself. V'achar kach amar hamavir et avir habara. And then it says, the person who brought along the fire. What does that mean? He says, we think it, the fire went all out by itself. And it left her. But the Pasuk says, a fire goes out and a person spreads a fire. And therefore, we treat the person who allowed the fire to go out as if he actively engage in sending the fire out. We hold them to a higher level of responsibility. So it says, the fourth line, second word, Dvarze, in this matter, Lefi Chozek HaFa'al Shel Eish, because of the nature of the action of fire, Shehu Po'el B'Koach V'Tokef, that it's so powerful in attacking, Tala Katu B'Misha Eish Tachat Rishuto, we hold the person in whose property the fire existed, ki'ilu hayahu apoel, as if he was the actual actor in extending the fire. Lefichach, therefore, he has written that he actually must have to pay, ki'ilu ba'atzmo pa'alze, as if he himself did this, and therefore he has to pay this. It's an interesting parallel. I don't want to get into that right now for a whole series of different reasons, but the parallel is there. It's an interesting parallel in that regard, that we don't live by ourselves in a lifeboat, that we all are in the same lifeboat, and therefore we have a responsibility for one another. Okay, let me go a step further. Let's skip over the second Netzach Yisrael and go to Rabbeinu Bechaye, who takes us one step further and says, you know what, we're up until now we've said, you're going to be responsible for fire almost no matter what. If you light a fire, you're going to be responsible, which just strengthens our question. Why do the rabbis therefore say, you're allowed to have a fire? Why do they say that you're allowed to have anger, right? If that's the parallel. Why are you allowed to have machloket? They should outlaw these things, and they should also outlaw fire altogether. If you're going to be responsible no matter what, if it's in your property, don't have it at all. But we allow fire, anger. It's not a good thing, but we allow elements in there. The Rabbeinu Bechaye says as follows. Ki teitzei ish, same pasuk. Me'atzma, by itself, shalem yishalem. He's responsible, he has to pay. Ma'avir et ha've'era. The person who allowed the fire to go out has to pay. Shemi shehevir et ha'esh haya. Siba shilema hu she'evir et ha'esh lo hayta ha'esh yotzet me'atzmo sorefet et ha'gadish or ha'kama. Right, the same points we've been making thus far. It's as if he's responsible, even though he himself did not do it. The Darshu Razal and our sages, they give a drash on this. Mikra zeh b'bavakama al chorban beit hamikdash. It's like the beit hamikdash. Shekatuv sham in Yeshayahu. It's written there. Beit Kodshenu v'Tifartenu, our Beit Mikdash, Asher, right? That our fathers were involved. Hayal l'Srefat Eish, v'Anu Garamnu Shekikalnu. We burned down the Beit Mikdash. We didn't burn it down. The Romans burned it down. But how did Chazal? They took everything we've just said into now and said, if the tzaddikim are going to be held responsible, if you're going to be held responsible for what the fire that takes place on your property, as if you yourself lit it, so we are actually held responsible for what the Romans did in destroying the Beit HaMikdash, because they did it with fire, and we allowed that fire to take place because of our sins. So it happens to be. Now, all these sources that I brought are sort of leaders of the Musar movement. And they are making that argument to a certain extent that we're responsible, and that's what Chazal does very often, that we're responsible for everything. Now, it's important, goes back to your point. The fact that we're responsible does not relieve the responsibility of the wicked, right? We always say that we may have caught, we may have allowed these sins to take place because of our sins, but a person who actually engages in the evil, the Romans, the Nazis, they're still 100% responsible as well. Retroactively, Chazal, I mean, this is a big question of good and evil, but you're absolutely right. That's what they're arguing, and it's an extreme position to a certain extent that they learned out from being responsible for fire that you didn't have anything to do with. Which, again, strength of scripture, so why allow it? That's correct. The idea of being responsible, even if not causing something, right? What does a kid do more than anything else? I didn't do it. And what does the parent always say to the kid? I don't care. You know, you could have stopped it. You know, your sibling, you know, I remember when I was about, must have been 7 or 8 years old, I was selling candy in upstate New York. You know, the school gave me stuff to sell candy. And I went with my sister, who must have been 4. And we got up to one street, and I said to myself, and I said to my sister, you know, we can make a lot more money if we split up. I'll go this way, and you go that way. So she's 4 years old. What does she know? She goes that way, and I go this way. I come home about an hour later, and my mother says, where's your sister? I said, oh, she's not home yet? She went the other way. I told her to go the other way. And my mother let me have it and said, how could you possibly let your sister do that? I said, I didn't do anything. You know, she went her way. You know, she agreed with me. She thought it made sense. She said, I don't care if you did it. You are responsible for your sister, right? You know the famous joke about the brothers who are at the Shabbos table and they're sitting around the Shabbos table. You know, they don't have, one of the brothers doesn't have a kippah on, and the father's saying Kiddush. And the father turns to the son who has the kippah and says, you know, put your hand on your brother so he's covered when he's saying the bracha. And he says Kiddush, but the father's making it long with chasanut and everything like this. The brother's arm hurts, so he pulls down his arm. And the father says, put it back on. And the brother says, what do you want from me? Am I my brother's kippah? Okay. But that is, in fact, what the Torah is saying. That even if you're not responsible for the bad, you're responsible to make it better. Okay, we have that sense of responsibility that is taught by this lesson of fire. Yeah, thank God. Oddly enough, just to sort of impress the point of that it was potentially a dangerous thing, the mortician in the town saw her on the street, and she was staying at the mortician's house for us to go pick her up afterwards. He called out. He was a Jewish guy. He called us, everything like this. But it was a little bit odd, you know, to get a call from the mortician that your sister is there. So kind of something I always remember. Okay. So you see here, the next source, the Yalkut Shimoni, does something even further. It says, not only are we, right, this is, now we're going to get almost very Hasidic. Not only are we responsible for the evil, I wrote in my Torah, that my is probably a mistake, that my should be capitalized, because who are we talking about now? God. He who started the fire must make restitution. That's our verse. And I ignited the fire, right? Because we have a verse that says, when in Yirmiyahu and in Lamentations, what we read on Tisha B'Av, from above he, Hashem, sent the fire to destroy the city. And I will build it by fire in the future, as it says, and I myself, declare the Lord, will be a wall of fire around it. In other words, not only as human beings, but God is also responsible, and he teaches us something else. If you destroy with fire, you have to build with fire. This sort of conflation of a lot of different things, I think, is essential to understand how the rabbis understood fire. You see two things. You see that first of all, fire emanates from God, and that it has this creative power, right? It's what's going to rebuild the city as much as it's going to destroy the city. So therefore, you have to let there to be fire in the world, right? Fire is a positive thing. There's the famous Gemara. I think I brought it. Yeah. If you look down below in Bereshit Rabbah and then Yoma, This is the famous case of the Yetzer Hara, that the rabbis wanted to destroy the Yetzer Hara, which, by the way, is compared to a fiery lion. And they starved this fiery lion, and they thought this is the greatest thing in the world. We destroyed the fire, the destructive power of the Yetzer Hara. And then what happens, and you see in the Gemara in Yoma, they captured it, they imprisoned the Yetzer Hara, and they ordered a complete fast for 3 days. The Yetzer Hara surrendered to them. He came forth from the Holy of Holies like a fiery lion. He, the Yetzer Hara, said to them, "Realize that if you kill me, the world is finished." They held him for 3 days, and the whole world became desolate. There was not a man who was building a house. There was not people getting married. There was no eggs being laid. That if you take away the fire of the Yetzer Hara, so things are not going to be built. You need to have that fire in order to create the world. And so the first thing is that destruction and creation are linked. The second thing is that power of destruction and creation is given over to human beings. Think about all of the, like for example, the second gift that God gives humankind is fire. That's why we make a blessing of Borei Pri Ha'esh when it comes to Havdalah. There's a blessing in fire, and it was given over to human beings. And not just, I see I'm short on time, so I want to sort of tie it together. Think about all the positive elements fire is used in terms of God. We have fire at Har Sinai. We have fire in the burning bush. We have the pillar of fire. You go on and on and on. God uses fire as this positive force, also uses fire as the Yetzer Hara, but also positive in that regard. And we have that same power. God gave us the ability to, if we go back to Lag BaOmer, teach Torah through fire, like to be passionate about it. It's not enough just to know Torah, but you have to to set it aflame. We have the ability to protect people, like the God protected us while we were in the desert, right? God calls out to Moshe by name. It's very personal. God is not a distant God. God calls Moshe's name at the burning bush, right? And there, the fire is not destroying. The fire is illuminating, right? The most famous case where the Rambam describes how is it that Avram was chosen? This is the Eitz Yosef that I had mentioned earlier. How is it that Avram is chosen? It says that he's walking around and he sees a palace that is on fire, or illuminated. He peeks in and he says, if there's lights on in this palace, there must be an owner. And who is the owner? At that point in time, God reveals God's self, peeks in and says, I'm the owner, I'm the Baal HaBayit. The Eitz Yosef says the Hebrew, daluk, can mean it's illuminated, the palace, but daluk could also mean on fire. And it's possible that what really inspired Avram to search for God is he sees a palace on fire. He sees the world on fire. He sees the world being destroyed. And he's inspired to do something about it. He wants to make the world a better place. He says, how is it possible that the world can be destroyed and there's no owner? God peeks out and says, I am the owner. There is the world being destroyed by fire. But now you and I have to do something about it. And God gives us the power to try to improve. What fire really represents more than anything else is the ability of taking God's creative powers and taking them as ourselves and hopefully improving the world as a result of that. And you see fire very often as a tikkun on a lot of ways. You have the fire, the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And what did we do just last week? We had Hanukkah. With fire was our response to the destruction by fire. We use fire in this positive way. I just want to end by showing you two quick things. First is the last source is the Sukkot liturgy. At the very end of Sukkot, we say this, I quoted it in English, but you probably know, Be'esh, Be'esh, Be'esh is one of the things we say. If you look through this list, for the sake of the patriarch Abraham, who cast in the flames of fire, for the sake of Isaac, his son, it then talks about the Ten Commandments, it then talks about the Beit HaMikdash. There is a mixture. All of these are fire examples, but the mixture goes back and forth between God and man, right? God created this power to create and destroy, and then gives it to human beings. So we have in Matteo Dea, we have the ability to be B'Tselem Elokim, here with fire as well. And you see the liturgy is emphasizing, sometimes it's Aaron, sometimes it's David, sometimes it's the Beit HaMikdash, it's Solomon, Eliyahu, Hashem. And the end, we beseech you, all connected to this concept of fire. And just the last point that I would make is I'll connect it to something that Rabbi Sacks says. Rabbi Sacks says you see this partnership. He's actually talking about religious extremism. And he says that fire is symbolic of potential, our desire to be like God. And he says it's very important to do, but you have to be careful. Especially when it comes to religion. He says, for example, the first murder was Cain killing Abel because over a religious dispute. He says the Crusaders, they thought they were taking God's will. We're going to convert people, but abusing it. And so he says, with the story of Nadav Yavihu, which is fire, God sends down a fire to consume the sacrifice. That's a positive. God says, here, I want to connect with you. Nadav and Vavu take their own fire, and it's a strange fire, and then God sends a third fire, and the third fire is to consume them. And he therefore says that's the challenge of sort of religiosity. But I take sort of a deeper point, which is there's a dance between us and God. God gives us a gift. We have to treat that gift responsibly, right? Super responsibly, if you think about it. And when we do that, then God also connects in that. And fire is a symbol of that relationship that we have. Have a good week.